This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about family support. And for this intro, it's just me. It was a little bit difficult to schedule with Annie, and she's part of the Brighton Fringe currently, so is off busy rehearsing for that right now. However, I'm prepped with all my stats to talk about family support in what is, I think, a really brilliant episode to come. First off, I want to highlight that whilst family support can be a really wonderful asset in mental health recovery for those that receive it, it is also really important to be mindful of how you're supporting your own mental health when caring for somebody else. So I've got some good information on that from the Mental Health Foundation, who said, looking after a family member with a mental health problem can have significant impact on the carer's own mental health. Mental health problems of carers include emotional stress, depressive symptoms, and in some cases, clinical depression. I found that one particularly poignant, and actually the guest that we have on today deals with depression. So it was a really clear example of that link there, where in some cases supporting someone else's mental health can be enough of a drain on you that it can impact your own mental health in quite a similar way. I just wanted to start off in that, but more so this episode we're going to be talking about loads of the wonderful positive effects of family support. And so for that, from Sane, when families are accepted as partners in care and do receive training and support, there is strong evidence that this leads to better outcomes for everyone involved. That can be as simple as reading up on the symptoms or a condition that a family member, friend, or someone else in your social circle are dealing with as a way to better understand and support them. Also, the Centre for Social Justice highlighted how common family support is. So they found 30,000 children are currently on the UK waiting list for NHS child and adolescent mental health services. But evidence-based parenting interventions can have a significant and positive impact. So that's not to say for a moment that family support should be put in lieu of the support from the NHS, but it can in many cases be a positive way to support them whilst their help is on the way. So there are a few bits of information we found for that. And then I've also looked into a little bit more stats specific to this week's guest. And so I wanted to get some stats for Irish mental health as well. So first off, a report published in the Irish Times in April this year found that Ireland has one of the highest mental illness rates in Europe. And IrishHealth.com found it is estimated that at any one time, 280,000 people in Ireland have depression. And as European countries go, their population is relatively small. So that is more than it sounds. It equates to about 1 in 17 people. Another piece of information I found interesting from the Irish College of Psychiatry of Ireland, a title that seems unnecessarily long, they did research into gender differences when it comes to depression, which I found quite interesting. Their research noted that while many women, when they are depressed, are obviously sad, men are more commonly irritable, have angry outbursts, and are likely to take greater risks. Men are also more likely to abuse alcohol when depressed and more likely to commit suicide. So I think these are things that are commonly acknowledged, but it's an interesting thing to bear in mind when so often depression can be stereotyped as just one thing. It's nice to see how they're highlighting potentially angry outbursts or being irritable or increased risk-taking. Alcohol abuse can all be symptoms just as much as the perhaps more commonly understood depression symptoms. And then final stat I wanted to highlight is going across to the country of Northern Ireland. where it was found in the Youth Mental Health Report, Northern Ireland has a serious self-harm and suicide problem, with around 11,000 episodes of deliberate self-harming each year, and up to 500 suicide deaths reported. So this is another one that I wanted to highlight because within the UK, Northern Ireland does have the highest rate of self-harm and suicide. And I feel like that's perhaps sometimes overlooked. I'm not sure if maybe it's that because the population is so much smaller than a country like England, for example, some of the numbers can't seem as big, but actually proportionally they're very high. So on that relatively sobering note, I'm looking forward to diving into mental health in Ireland, including how wonderful family support can be in your mental health recovery, with this week's guest. So he is John Connell, an incredible writer whose book spent 33 weeks in the top 10 charts for best-selling books in Ireland, and he was an absolute delight to talk to. I'm looking forward to sharing his insight. We also get into some of the impact of emigrating, some of the impact of being away from family, as well as how much it benefited him to return home, spend more time with family, and really return to a slower pace of life on the family farm that he grew up on. So before we get into that interview, I've got just two last things. With it being UK Mental Health Awareness Week, we're increasing our activity. So first off, tomorrow we will be releasing an extra special episode all about mental health stigma. So we've got some wonderful fellow podcasters and previous guests to record snippets of themselves talking about how mental health stigma affects them. So look out for that in your podcast feed coming out tomorrow. Also, one of the people you'll hear from in that bonus episode tomorrow, Fiona Thomas, co-hosts a podcast with Amy Holland that I am on this week. So this week's episode of the Positive People podcast, I'm the guest talking all about mental health in the workplace. So if you want to check that out, I'll drop a link for that in the episode description. So that's everything else to look out for this year's Mental Health Awareness Week. In a moment, we'll get into the episode, but first, this week's self-care partner. Reading can be such an incredible act of self-care, and reading a book about mental health even better. So this week, I'm recommending our guest book, The Farmer's Son, and I'm going to read a little excerpt of its description. Already a sensation in Ireland, where this book spent 33 weeks on the top 10 Irish bestsellers list, and 6 weeks at number one, The Farmer's Son is a triumphant and stirring memoir that will resonate with anyone who has struggled with mental health. Also, as I grew up on reading a lot of Roddy Doyle books, he's also reviewed this, so I thought I'd read his review. I usually view rural Ireland from a train or car window, but reading this gripping, fascinating book, I felt I was becoming a cattle farmer. So if you want to try this book or any other first book with Audible, you can get your first one free with our link bit.ly/mentalbooks. The details will also be in the episode description.
John Connell is my name. I'm a writer and a farmer and a filmmaker. And I was born in a very small place called Longford in Ireland. It's in the Midlands of the country. And I suppose if it were the US, it would be part of the flyover states. It's not a very famous place, but it is my home. And I grew up here working on the land as a young man for about 12 years of my life. I lived in Australia and Canada and America. And that was a journey I suppose I needed to take to get to know myself. But on that journey, it's also when I discovered I had mental health problems. We have to remember, if we wind the clock back, only 20 years ago, suicide was illegal in Ireland. So that gives you a fair insight into the country's view on mental health. The view is that it wasn't talked about. We talk about it in Ireland. There was no facilities. There was no language around it. So growing up for me, you might hear about someone who suffered with their nerves, which was an Irish way of saying that they might have had mental health problems. But there was no language. Now, thankfully, Ireland's changed a lot. Suicide isn't illegal anymore. And, you know, I suppose the whole campaigns now are led on protecting people, and mental health is a discussed topic. But growing up, it wasn't. And I suppose when I had my own difficulties, I had no even language to comprehend or describe what was happening because I would never been taught that.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. And was that something you were aware of at the time? If somebody said about a person struggling with their nerves, did you have any idea of what that meant?
I didn't really. You know, I suppose I thought this person's probably a bit odd, or there's something maybe different with them, or they're touched a little bit. But no, I had absolutely no comprehension of it. And it was only mental health came rushing into my life when my uncle sadly took his life when I was about 13. I remember my mother describing it as, well, he was sick. And I suppose that was the first time that the conversation happened. But being so young, I didn't really comprehend it all, and I certainly didn't take it in. I kind of told myself, well, he's sick, and that's why he's dead, and I didn't really understand, you know, he took his life. So it was there, but it certainly wasn't discussed. And for me, I didn't even make myself aware of it until it happened to me.
And that's interesting how you'd had this experience of a close family member. And yeah, it sounds like it was talked about more like a physical health condition, right?
Yes, I think so. It was described, I suppose, the way that if someone had cancer and they said, well, he's dead now. So it was described as that. And I think also those were the words that we had to tell ourselves, well, he's sick. And that's what happened. Otherwise, other questions are raised. But I remember when my uncle did die, my grandmother, who's now passed herself, said that perhaps some good could come out of this. And it wasn't until 15 years later or more that the good did come out, which was my own family's response to my mental illness. And in a sense, that was a way to, for my family, all of them, the greater family, got a second chance to amend a wrong and amend a spiritual wrong to enable them to rectify a situation for the second time that had happened in the family in a short space of time. So, yeah, out of tragedy can come positivity.
That's a really lovely way of looking at it. And so could you talk us through then what did happen when you were in Australia?
My life was pretty great for quite a long time there. I went there as an exchange student. And in being there, I met a series of people who changed my life for the better. I won a number of journalism prizes for my investigation work. I worked as an investigative journalist and ended up with a production company making TV programs and films. And life was really wonderful until it wasn't. You know, we have a phrase in Irish, in Gaelic, which says, Ocrus Aron Dawn, which means a hunger for the world. And I had a hunger for the world. I wanted to do it all, take it all in, and have as many experiences as possible. And in a sense, I was greedy to have these experiences. And so rather than have one job, I had a business and two jobs. And I was working along and things were great and living on energy drinks, it must be said. And I remember one night coming home, it was about 11 or 12, I'd worked till midnight again. And I had this experience happen where I couldn't breathe and I couldn't speak. And I was lying in bed with my then girlfriend. And I remembered, I don't know how I remembered, because telling you earlier, you know, there was no talk of mental health and there was no skills built into our young people at the time. But I think I'd seen something on television that had described a panic attack. And I said, I think I'm having a panic attack. Of course, I had to write that down because I couldn't speak. And that was really the beginning of my mental health difficulties. And I was about 23. And I got over that. And I went back to work, continued working. And I was just about to do the biggest production of my life. It was a big documentary, and I had about 20 employees working for me. And slowly, I started to push people away. And the funny thing with mental health difficulties is when you are going down that rabbit hole, it feels like you've figured it all out and everyone else is wrong. And that was certainly my experience. I said, well, everyone's wrong and I'm right and they don't get it, but I do. And I remember we came home at Christmas, my girlfriend and I, And I went to Mass, and the priest was singing Silent Night. And while he was a great singer, he wasn't that good, but I started to cry. And I said to my girlfriend, you know, I don't think I can go back to Australia. And she said, well, why don't you take a holiday? And I said, well, I can't. I've got this big documentary to do. So I didn't take a holiday, went back to Australia. And that was really the beginning of it all. I did the documentary, but began to fall out with people. And slowly, this phrase built in my mind of let it burn, let it all go to hell. And I did. I pushed everyone away, and the pub became my friend, and I was drinking. And
with your then girlfriend suggesting that you stay for a holiday in Ireland and spend more time with family, what was kind of going through your head of that decision that you had to go back?
Well, I suppose there was a contract that was going through my head. I had a business and employees, and I needed to go back and make it all happen. And there was people depending on me. It wasn't just about me anymore. It was about other people. And I could have taken off a few weeks. January in Australia is a very quiet time. Mm-hmm. It's the summer holidays over there. So I could have taken a holiday. But when you're young and you've had success, you feel that you have to do everything yourself. And that's, of course, a sign of inexperience, really. But I felt like I had to do it all myself rather than trust other people to be able to do their areas. And I suppose I put myself in a box of, well, you can't stay here, you have to go back, you have to do this, rather than the catchphrase of self-care. You know, I didn't know anything about self-care then. I just knew about work. And I come from an entrepreneurial family, so all it was work, work, work. And you took a break when you were burnt out. That was it. You know, you didn't take a break when you should do. And of course, the best time to take a holiday is when you don't need it, you know?
Yeah, before you really need it.
Yeah, before you really need it. And of course, I didn't know about anything about that. And I suppose there was a certain little bit of greed as well. I'd been having success with my programs and projects, and I wanted more of it. And there was a dopamine thing going on, I suppose, of I loved the thrill of business, so I wanted to keep myself being busy, and stopping and standing still wasn't an option, because when you stop and stand still, maybe things don't feel as good. And certainly looking back at that time when I would stop and stand still, I wouldn't feel good about things. So that was probably an underlying little thing that was bubbling away and had been for a long time.
Yeah, and that's certainly something I have to keep an eye on in myself, that I set appropriate boundaries with my work, because there's that fine line between work being something productive you're doing that is appropriate for you to center your life on, and it being a distraction from your problems.
You're bang on there. We have to find balance, and I think the person who has found balance in their life hasn't been born yet, because none of us have figured it out. But certainly I didn't know anything about balance, and it's something I still work at, to try and, you know, have the, what is it, the 8-hour work day, 8-hour pleasure and 8-hour sleep. You know, you try and do all of that, and it's very hard to figure it all out. And particularly as a creative person, whether you're in film or journalism or whatever, as humans, we define ourselves so much by our profession. So some professions are very full on, and so we take joy in the long hours. You know, some people say, I love my business and I work really late hours. But actually, that's a sign of bad management. You shouldn't have to work late hours. You should be able to do a normal day's work and go home. If you're working crazy hours, it's because you don't have enough staff or you are not setting enough boundaries yourself. Of course, anyway, rewinding back to 23, 24 years of age, I had no concept of that at all. So,
And I'm interested to know, with the context of emigration being such a part of still the Irish culture and identity, did you feel at all that because so many people emigrate, you should just be fine being away from home? You should be able to cope with that?
You know, that's a very interesting question. Emigration is part of the Irish story. It's what we do, you know. The economy, of course, tanked in 2008 in the GFC. So there wasn't really a lot of options for people to come home at that time, and a lot of, and thousands, tens of thousands of people left again. And, you know, we were supposed to be a generation that didn't have to leave.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, I think when you become an immigrant, nothing's ever the same again, because if you make your home somewhere else, even if you come back like I've done, you're always judging it on the place where you lived as before. And there were certain things in Australia that I would judge and look at them in, from an Irish context. And now that I live in Ireland again, there are certain things I judge here and look at it in an Australian context. Mm. So, yeah, once you make that journey, life isn't the same. And, you know, I've heard many immigrants talk about this. That's the journey that they're on. And being Irish and leaving was part of it. And you do allow yourself to feel homesick. The thing is, before things were bad in Australia for me, they were very good. So I had a great circle of friends and a girlfriend who's now my wife. So, you know, it was a pleasurable experience, and I was young and it was exciting. So the homesickness would come every so often, but, you know, that could be solved by a phone call. You know, it wasn't like immigrants of 50 years ago. Once you left, that was it. You know, yeah. Modern technology meant that we could talk, and it made life easier. And then having a great circle of friends who were all Australian, I had made a point of integrating into the country rather than, and I think that's the secret for immigrants, is if you integrate into a society, then it can start to feel like home. Whereas if you isolate yourself into your expat or immigrant bubble, you'll never fully integrate, and then you'll always remain outside. Mm. So my philosophy was, when I went there, I said, I'm going to be an Australian and live as an Australian. So I remember reading a lot of Australian books, watching a lot of Australian films, reading Australian history, so I could understand that culture and make it a part of me.
Yeah, that's a really good way of looking at it. It sounds like you'd really figured a lot out there from a young age of what it means to be an immigrant and how best you would be able to cope with that. And that was all before things became harder again. So could you talk us through how your mental illness symptoms kind of developed in the later part of your life there?
Yeah, I was building up to this project and this big documentary, and I was pushing everyone away. And I suppose it started with the panic attacks, and then it built into, I suppose, a little bit of a paranoia about other people pushing people away, thinking that I'd had it all figured out, until finally it came to this particular night. I'd been working towards getting this journalism award called the Walkley, and I'd won it. And the night I went to pick it up, I had fallen out with everyone and pushed away all my friends and my girlfriend. And I realized I had just totally imploded my life. And I came back to Ireland under the pretext to write a book. I'd signed a book deal, and I came back to write this book. And I was at home for a few weeks. I was very angry with everyone. And I remember kind of switching off my Australian phone, and I wasn't taking any calls from people. And then one night I had another panic attack, a very, very bad one, and I woke up crying. And that was the beginning of depression for me. That was the beginning of that time. And with the depression came obviously a lot of downs and everything else, but I went to the doctor in Ireland, and he said, "You're depressed." And I said, "No, I'm not. I'm just stressed out. I'm working on X, Y, and Z, blah, blah, blah." But it took me a number of months to accept that I was depressed and that I needed help. And even as I accepted that, I didn't want to take any medication or anything like that. So it took another couple of months. And of course, I was working at the same time writing this book. And then that started really a journey of about 4 years with mental health difficulties, on and off, until I'd ended up in Canada, living in Canada, working as a filmmaker, until life imploded for a second time in the space of 4 years. And it was then that I knew that I have a problem and that I need to deal with this. And the depression was so bad that on the second period, I didn't leave my room for a couple of months. And that was a really scary time. It was a horrendous time. You see, I was someone who traveled my whole life, my whole adult life, as a filmmaker, journalist, went around the world. But the most important journey that I had to take was the one inside. And that's the hardest journey there is, because there's no roadmap. But that was, I suppose, the most important journey I ever took, and the one that led me to find peace. And I found peace in unusual places and in unusual things. And I tried a lot of things to get better, but it took a combination of old world and new world medicine and new age thinking to finally transform myself, have a transformation of the soul. And, you know, I think people who go through mental health difficulties, it is a moment of spiritual questioning and a spiritual awakening. And I'm not talking about organized religion or anything like that. I'm talking about you're asking the very elemental questions of who we are, what makes us tick, how do I be happy, what is love? And those were questions I had never asked myself before and had probably found them to be a bit new agey. Actually, they're the very key concepts of life. Because when your mental health is suffering, they're the only questions that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And within the context of you growing up, do you feel that those around you are asking these kind of questions?
No, those questions weren't really asked. The great trick of humanity is that we spend most of our time thinking we'll never die, and most of our time thinking about the future. We don't think about the present moment, or we're depressed and we're thinking about the past. It's very tricky to live in the now, but if you live in the now, you ask yourself those questions. But we're so busy getting on with life, as is the human condition, that we are not faced with those questions until something stops us. Now, there certainly was a spiritual grounding in my life from my family being raised as a Roman Catholic. There was a certain spiritual aspect. But the bigger questions weren't asked, or if they were, they were said in passing. So I had to go on a journey of learning and reading and listening to discover those questions, but also what worked for me.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you've mentioned religion there, because I'm curious to know. I certainly have the feeling that a lot of the strength of religion in Ireland puts at times too many answers into God, so potentially family problems or health problems, and there's this kind of expectation that it's not for us to decide what the answers to these big issues are.
It is. I mean, I grew up on a farm, so you would certainly say, well, there's the hand of God in that, or it's up to God to decide this. If we're talking about older Celtic Ireland, and I include the Roman Catholicism in that, I'm still a practicing Catholic, by the way. It's still something in my life. But there's a mystical side of Irish Christianity, which is Celtic spirituality. And that is seeing God in nature and seeing God in things. And it's a little bit like American Transcendentalism as well, that we see God in nature. So if your worldview is seeing God in all these things, then of course you offer it up to a higher power. You say, well, that's the way it is because it's God's will. And at times that can be very helpful, and at other times it can be quite cruel, because I remember in my own journey questioning, why would God do this to me? I was a good person. Why did he punish me with this? And that took me a while to figure that out. And of course, then having been a Catholic, the guilt that I pushed on myself was based around a Catholic model of guilt. So I have Jewish friends, and it's a similar level of guilt. So, but it's framed in good and evil and things like that. So, yeah, it's changed in Ireland, but there are still people who think like that. And, you know, at times offering it up to a higher power is very helpful, but at other times it can be very destructive.
Well, because it's not that there can't be a religion angle towards your health and your family life and creating kind of healthy habits through religion. That's absolutely something people can do. But it's at the same time balancing that with not putting everything into religion.
I think that's it, you know, and that's something I've read a lot of different religions and understand them, whether it was as a journalist or on my own journey. you know, if we put too much faith into anything, whether, you know, I'm big into exercise, and, you know, I know people who've went through a similar journey and they just said, well, I'll exercise my way to being better. But of course, that becomes an obsession in and of itself. And religion has a big tendency to become an obsession. That's why, of course, we see people commit terrorist acts under the name of religion. But because religion gives certain answers, we can put too much hope into it. And with mental health, again, we talked about balance, but it is about finding the balance in the spiritual side of our life, the physical side, the mental side, finding a balance with all of them and finding the recipe that works for you. The recipe that works for me may not be the same that works for the next chap. For a long time with my depression, I tried to think my way out of it. I used my mind a lot, so I said, well, I can think my way out of this. But you can't think your way out of an illness. The old expression my doctor used to say was, if you had diabetes, you'd take insulin. So what's wrong if you've got mental illness taking a tablet to treat it, you know? There are still certain stigmas in society around mental illness, but those stigmas also leave an imprint on people on their way of thinking about mental health. So we have to find new ways to program our mind to think about it, because like all illnesses, it can be treated. And if it's treated properly, we can have a better life. And the first step is accepting that we are not well and that the thoughts I'm having are not my own thoughts. They're passing thoughts, but I'm having trouble moving them. And so I have to find a way to deal with that. But that first step of acceptance can take an awful long time.
And it sounds like it really did in your case. How were you able to accept your diagnosis and sort of see it more as a part of you?
Well, you know, the truth is, the first time I had the depressive episode, I didn't really deal with it, and I got over it and got back into the world, and I stopped taking my medication. And it was only in the second time, when things fell apart fully with my fiance in Canada, that I said, I have a problem, I need to deal with this, and I need to deal with it in the correct way. So I need to go to a doctor, I need to go to a therapist, I need to change my life. This was 2 years into my mental health journey, and I finally said, look, your life's blown up again in your face, so obviously something's really wrong. It's not everyone else, you, so you need to deal with this, and deal with it the way you would deal with any project or film or anything like that you've worked on, and make it your focus. And it became my focus for about 2 years to get better. And in that time, I had the inner journey, the spiritual awakening, but also the physical awakening. And that allowed me to, it took those years. And, you know, if I look back on it, sometimes I look at friends who haven't had mental health problems, and I say, God, their life's pretty good now, and it's pretty stable. And I regret those lost years. But at the same time, there's a very simple caveat that I tell myself, well, you're alive. So being alive is pretty good. And then secondly, I've helped other people by talking about my journey, and my own life's pretty good right now. So life is a way of getting better once you're better yourself. You're no good to anyone else if you can't help yourself. So the most important thing to do is be happy yourself. I remember my fiance at the time saying to me, you know, I can't be the one to make you happy. You have to make yourself happy. It hurt at the time, her saying that, but it's a very true thing. We have to make ourselves happy first in order to help other people be happy.
Absolutely. And I think that's an incredibly common misconception when it comes to relationships, that many people, particularly younger people, put the responsibility for their happiness into their partner.
We're looking for, I think, you know, we're trying to replicate our parental relationship. So you look to your parents to go, well, they give me love and they make me happy, so this person I'm with should do the same. But actually, you have to plough your own furrow, to borrow a farming phrase. But you have to make yourself happy first, and then you have to be complete yourself. And when you're complete, see, there's three things in a relationship. There's you, there's your partner, and then there's the relationship. That comes with maturity too. And in a sense, we'll have to go through the bad relationships in order to get to the good one.
That's a good way of looking at it. And that's, I think, quite a writer's way of looking at it. Like, you have to do a certain number of pages sometimes to get to that really good paragraph.
Yeah, yeah. That's true, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that we should be ploughing through relationships and casting them aside, but I think when we're young, we learn about ourselves first, and then we're learning about other people. And for some people, they figure it out quite quickly, but other people, like myself, takes a while, and you learn by your mistakes. And, you know, you look back and you go, would I do it any differently? You'd say, well, no, because I wouldn't have learned what I now know.
Absolutely. And I think the final thing I'd mention there is the important distinction between when it does come to relationships and happiness, that person is able to support your happiness, but they're not able to create it.
Exactly. That's a spot on way of looking
at it. And so to talk a little bit about other relationships in your life, you mentioned earlier how your family kind of got a second chance when it came to supporting a family member with mental illness. So how did they respond when you returned and you were experiencing the depression?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I'd been the golden boy, things had went so well, and then he's back at 28 and things are not good and he won't get out of the room or get out of the bed. And it was a second chance, but it was certainly a hard chance and a hard won struggle for them all. But I probably wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for my mother, who took care of me. In Ireland, we don't have an NHS, so it's a private healthcare system. So unless you have pretty good private insurance, there is no mental health care available. Or if there is, it's on a very, very long waiting list. So my mother had to nurse me, really, through that time. And if it wasn't for her, I would probably be dead. And my family were... We all went through various phases. You know, there was anger, there was loss, there was sadness. But then, slowly, as things got better, there was happiness. And, you know, it was a very tough time. But it brought us all closer together, and my extended family too. And my family were really wonderful through it. And you know, my dad really wasn't able to deal with it in some sense, because men of his generation don't talk about these things, and it was tough for him. But he did care, and he did want me to get better. And I suppose there was a learning in it for all of my family, because they didn't know. No one in the, aside from my Uncle Joe, who you know, they hadn't had to deal with him when he was depressed, they didn't really know how to deal with these things. So it took a knowledge process for all of them to understand about mental illness. And mental illness was a word that we talked about a lot for during that time, you know, during those 6 months. And slowly then, as I was undergoing all that, I was undergoing the journey of the self and arming myself and understanding mental health. And it was like taking a degree in mental health, you know. I learnt everything about it, so I understood the illness. And when I understood it, I was able to name things. And then in naming things, my family could understand what I was going through. And slowly, things got better. But if it wasn't for my support network of my family and my extended friends around the world, I wouldn't be here. So for those listening, I suppose, that are undergoing those concerns, the most important thing is having a support network. And we all need that. If you're going on this journey alone, it's a very tough journey. Yeah.
And what I'm hearing from that experience is there's a through line with all of your family that they really tried to understand. And I think that's so important. You don't need to have all the knowledge and know all the conditions and all the symptoms to support someone experiencing mental illness, but you can try and learn and try and support them. And that's where the real power is.
Yes, that's it exactly, you know. And just knowing that there's someone there, if you need to talk to them. For my big thing when I was depressed was I would get into a loop of thoughts, just obsessive thinking. And it would be very hard for me to get out of it. But having someone there just to listen to the same talk, that, you know, I would be saying the same thing days on end, but someone to listen. And I know for them, they were pretending that this was the first time they'd heard again, but just so they would listen and to know that you could say the story and not feel stupid about it, about saying it again. That was a wonderful thing. And, you know, I found in talking to other people that it's just as difficult for the person who isn't suffering from mental health, the carers and the family, as it is for the person who's suffering. But the person who's suffering doesn't realize that, because mental health can be a very introspective experience. But it's just, there's a sense of loss for the carers too. And we have to remember the carers and family in this. And they certainly don't get talked about enough, but they have a traumatic experience too. And they're the ones who are ultimately there to pick up the piece too, you know? So much love to them.
That's a really great point, because I think for many family members, when they've got someone going through mental illness and they've not had those kind of symptoms before, it can feel a lot like the person's changed and that they're dealing with a different version of that person. And there is a certain amount of grief that can cause. You're grieving how the person used to be. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a period of loss, because this is a different side to this person that you love that you don't know. And in a sense, there's a dialogue going on with the illness itself. You know, you're, as the carer, you're seeing and talking to the illness, and at times not talking to the person, you know. I'm not saying it's about disassociation, but actually, if we can disassociate the illness from the person, we can see this is the illness speaking here. And there is a period of grief, and it can be very traumatic for people because the person they love isn't there, you know, or it's only a thinly veiled version of them, or they only get to see the person they love every so often, you know, there's glimmers of them. And it's a tricky thing. And I've certainly helped other people who've had mental health difficulties, and I've seen it firsthand. You know, you want the person to get better, and they can't get better immediately. So it's very tricky. And you end up having the same conversation with them all the time. And you want them to be themselves again. And at times, it's frustrating because you want to say, come on, snap out of it. And even though I went through it myself, I felt like saying that to people, and because you know the goodness that's in them, but it's so tricky. You know?
And that can
it's
be so really tough to see, because so often mental illness really affects our entire sense of self and people's self-esteem and their self-worth. And so it can be so difficult to look on as a friend or family member and see how they're really struggling with that, and they're struggling to see their worth, yet you can see it.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, speaking on both sides there, I remember, you know, when a person is depressed, when they come out of it, they have to rebuild their confidence. And I remember that process myself. I remember taking myself on little day trips to different places and it being very scary and having to re-establish what it was to be in a crowd, re-establish what it was to go to a setting, to go to a dinner, to talk to people, and learning those things again. And that was a difficult process. But of course, it was all the more difficult for the carers and family and friends. They don't understand that confidence is gone, and they see a glimmer of the person. They go, "Okay, that's you. I want you back. Can you stay in that thought?" And of course, the person can't because they're dealing with the illness. So, having seen it both sides, it's a mind altering sort of thing, really, you know. And as carers, all we can do is simply be there, repeat the same mantras, urge the person to, you know, get their help and everything, and then wait it out. A lot of the time, depressive episodes will come in, you know, serious depressions come in for a period of time, and you know it will end with help, talking therapy or whatever it is, but the person needs to be consistent in their care to know that, yes, it will be over, but we're going to have to go through this, and it's going to take a little bit of time.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if we fast forward a little bit then to now, you're back living in Longford where you grew up and a part of the family farm again. So how was that experience changed things?
Well, thankfully, my mental health, seeing as the podcast about that, is very good. It, you know, I came back here to write a book. I was living in Australia again. I came back to write a book, and I ended up spending 3 years here writing three books, and the first two, which didn't succeed, and the third one being The Farmer's Son, which has done so well. But it was very interesting coming back here, because I hadn't intended to live in Ireland again, really. I didn't really know where I'd go after everything had fallen apart in Canada. But I came home to write a book, and then I ended up living here again, and my now wife moved from Australia and lives here. I hadn't lived in Ireland for so long. I had to make a network of friends and peers, and I'm still doing that. I'm still building up a friendship group. It was the right decision, because I needed to come home and I needed to settle myself. You know, the last part of the puzzle for me in mental health was finding peace. And I think in coming home again, even though it was to write a book, I finally found peace. And that peace has allowed me to help other people.
That's really lovely to hear. And so can we talk a little bit about your book?
Yeah, so the book is called The Farmer's Son. It came out in the UK as The Cow Book, but it's called The Farmer's Son in the US. And it's the story of my life. And really, it's the story of a man who went through a dark time, falling in love with life again. And the book is about the falling in love with life, not about the dark side. It's actually about the love bit. And that was the thing that, it was farming that brought me back. Farming that gave me the shock of the new, to borrow a phrase. But being in the present moment, I found, you know, that connection with the spiritual and physical side of life. And the book is about that. And it's also about the place I come from, the life I have lived. It's a memoir. The reason I talk about mental health stuff is after I went through my own journey, I ended up on national radio in Ireland and I was doing an interview and there was a man on his way to take his life that day and he happened to turn on the radio and he heard me speak and he wrote in the next day and he said, just when I was about to take my life, you came on the radio and I decided not to. You saved my life. And that, to me, made my 4 years all worthwhile. Because on a spiritual level, if I hadn't went through what I went through, there'd be one less person here. So to me, it all made sense. It was for a greater purpose. And it gave me strength. And that strength has stayed with me. Even when, you know, there's times where I've gotten a bit down or whatever, but never like that again. And it gave me the knowledge that if I keep doing what I'm doing, I'm helping people. It made me realize that we are all extraordinary people, but we're also totally ordinary, and we're no more special than the next person, because they're just as extraordinary as we are.
That's such a brilliant way of looking at it, and that's something that really comes across when talking to you or reading your work. You have such a positive outlook and ability to find the good in your darkest times, and not only is that really refreshing and magnetic, but also it's really counter to the depression stereotypes that somehow...
Yeah. Well, you know, I think at my heart, I was always a very positive and happy person. And depression came along and it was kind of a blip. And, people who are... a friend said this to me, my parish priest said it to me a long time ago, and it's very true. He said, people who are optimistic, even if they get the biggest knocks in life, eventually they return to optimism. And, and people who are pessimists, they can get big knocks and then they'll go back to being pessimists too, even if they've really fabulous experiences. So if you're a pessimistic person and you're listening to this, you have to change the wiring in your mind to look at the positive. And I was someone who was a worrier and I could see the bad in things. So I had to learn how to become optimistic about life. And, you know, as far as I know, we're only around for the one spin in this globe. So we might as well make it worthwhile and enjoy the moments when they're there and see the beauty of the ordinary bounty that's right in front of us.
Brilliant. I think that's a really lovely place to finish then. So we'll wrap up there. Is there Great. Anywhere, obviously there's your book, is there anywhere online you'd want to direct listeners to?
Well, I suppose you can go to Amazon, look up The Farmer's Son, you'll find it there. And I'm on Twitter at jconnelljtwo, and I'm also on Facebook, where I regularly talk to all my fans and readers about not just mental health, but, you know, writing or farming or organics and life in general. And I like talking to people, and I like hearing their stories. It's always good to hear from people who are on the road less traveled, because they're the ones who are, while they're picking up scars, they're also picking up a lot of love and a lot of experience. So hit me up.
Great. All right. So we'll wrap up there, then. It's been so lovely talking to you.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.